Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Fuller part-time options, 518-454-5143. From Northeast Public Radio, this is the Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project is underway once again for this week with the sounds of Pete Seeger starting us off. What a great thing that is. Welcome, folks, to a half hour of commentary analysis. And if we're lucky, a little bit of thoughtful insight into the media issues of the week. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, here with Rosemary Armeo, investigative journalist and professor at the University of Albany.
Hello. You couldn't even say that with a straight face. Thoughtful insight.
Perhaps. And Dr. Alan Shartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio, the commentator, columnist, and on all that stuff.
Yes, you know. And I just wanted to point out something in case our listeners haven't caught it yet, Rex, about you. Mm. And first of all, I want to thank you for taking this time. I know, in all honesty, you always look at me as if I'm lying.
When's he going to get me?
But speaking of lying, every time you go before you make a statement, I think that may be akin to Pinocchio's nose growing a little bit.
Aha! Here it comes. It's probably just that I haven't had enough of this caffeine to sort of wash down the throat.
And may it please the audience to know that I made that for you.
It's very kind.
Because, you know, I know my superiors when I see them.
Well, let's keep
intellectually
that.
Let's put that on the record. Other way.
On the record it is. We start with mail because you can, of course, participate in this program by sending us an email to media@wamc.org, which Fred of Canaan, New York did. But he addresses this to Alan specifically. He says, "Hey, Alan, a big fan of the Media Project, and I have a pressing question for your distinguished panel." Isn't that very nice, distinguished panel? Then here it comes. How is it that a Supreme Court justice can make such a blatantly racist remark without his legitimacy being challenged in the media? Degrading the intellectual ability of an entire race would never get past a town court in the USA, let alone the state level, and so on and so on. Why is this not being widely discussed? Is the guy with the comb-over so fascinating, that being Donald Trump, that Scalia will be allowed a pass by the media? I don't know which is a greater threat to our democracy.
Okay, and Rosemary's going to tell us exactly what it was that was said by
Scalia. I can do the setup here. The Supreme Court last week was hearing a case, Fisher versus University of Texas. It's a affirmative action case. And in the midst of this, we have a white woman who's arguing that she did not get into UT because she was graded simply on her qualifications, whereas minority students get in on something else, some other consideration.
A little affirmative action.
Right.
Another.
Yes. And in the course of the oral arguments, Justice Scalia said, well, you know, let me just ask this. Is it really fair to black children to let them into UT, a school that might be too hard for them? They don't do well there. Wouldn't it be better to put them in a lesser school where they might do better? So he actually, and I disagree with Fred, I think this has gotten huge coverage in the press. And
you stole my line.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
I wrote back to the guy and I said, he's a nice guy. And I said to him, so where did you see this?
Yeah.
In other words,
somehow
this information comes through osmosis into somebody's brain. No, it's because it was widely quoted.
It was.
Actually is an argument. We had a reading on it. Judges have written defense of Scalia, not saying that his comment or the sentiment that's read into it is right, that black people are lesser intellect or something like that. But this is, he didn't frame it right. He's so abrasive and just blurts out this stuff. What he actually may have been doing was asking about one of the big arguments used in these affirmative action cases, and that is that Black and other minority students are exploited by colleges. They accept them, is the argument, knowing they won't do well, but they don't care about that because they get a benefit out of it. They get to look like they're accepting Blacks, that they have a diverse population. So it actually, he asked a question that yes. needed to be answered in solving this case. And the judges who are defending him say, we have a problem when it's wrong to ask hard questions in our culture. We see that in the debates, too.
I think there's something to be said for that. I'm not much of a fan of Antonin Scalia, but if you look at the exact way that he phrased it, it was as though he was raising an issue that needed to be surfaced in the debate. And I should point out to Fred that all three of the national newspapers, that is the New York Times, USA Today, and the Wall Street Journal, we only have three truly national papers in this country, all three of them put the story on the front page, and they all had follow-up analysis pieces on their opinion pages. So it was widely covered.
So on a fairly regular basis, we do get comments. And as I said before, Fred's a good guy, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And I think
they called us distinguished, to your point. He did.
Yeah, well, that's right. That's right. But I think that quite often their passion takes over and they say, how come this isn't being reported? And my answer always is, how'd you find out about it? But the substance as well as the media aspect of this is interesting. You know, the city of New York at the City University at one point had what's called an open admissions policy. Anybody could come. It didn't work out. And no lesser light than Herman Badillo.
Mm-hmm.
Who graduated from CCNY and who is a famous politician in New York, came out and said, no, we have to have standards in order to get in, but everybody should have a place, including everybody should have a place, meaning that if they can't get into City College, they could go to a community college. This is not an unknown area of rhetoric, to tell you the truth.
You know, it's worth pointing out also that affirmative action, as currently practiced in the U.S., does not grant a free ticket to any minority student who wants to get into Harvard. It does not work that way. And it also should be pointed out that one of the key drivers of minority hiring as well as educational policies is the value of diversity. That is,
absolutely right.
When I go out to try to recruit a minority journalist in the old days when I used to be able to recruit people and fill vacancies, the notion was that diversity is a value in itself and that you need to have that in your newsroom. So that's part of what the Supreme Court, I hope, takes into consideration as they're listening to all of this. But, you know, one of the things that I think Fred's letter points out is one of the values of the new media. I used to feel really in the earlier days of this program before we had digital media, we would talk about this and I would say, well, we had that story, but of course, if you didn't happen to pick up the paper on that day, you didn't see it. That's less a factor with more and more information being transmitted via search or social media. People mm-hmm. are able to get access to what we've reported in the past anytime they want it. You just enter in, you can read my last column if you just Google
it.
The right
it was
words.
Excellent.
Just Google Rex Smith and Freud and you get it there, right?
Yes. Well, as you know, I'm a Freudian and I was very impressed. I thought maybe I had some influence on your life because we've had so many
discussions. No, it's my shrink who helped, yeah.
I see. Just kidding.
It's all good. It's a thoughtful thing. In the world of digital media, you can see more of that. All right. Speaking of Freudian, people sometimes try to apply Freudian analysis to our governor, Andrew Cuomo, to figure out whether there might, in fact, be sins of the father being visited upon the son, because we have watched this family over the years. But we have to talk just a moment about an interesting development that has great impact on the press here. There were a couple of bills on the governor's desk for open government, which he vetoed one day, and the next day he turned around and issued an executive order that he said would in fact do more than the bills he vetoed toward giving people access to information, in one case specifically under the Freedom of Information Law. It's an interesting path the governor has chosen, all in the course of the debate over how much access the public and the media ought to have to the documents of government.
Well, you know, this governor, when he was attorney general, hired the phenomenal Blair Horner in something called, I think it was Operation Sunrise. The whole idea was to make sure that the people of New York had absolute unfettered access to information. But you're right, Rex. It's very disturbing to me because he vetoes. We have three branches of government, and he vetoes the legislation that made it through both the Assembly and the Senate. And he says, no, I don't want this.
Yeah.
He obviously gets pilloried for, which rhymes with you know what, Hillary'd.
Oh, is that one of those words like orange that doesn't have a rhyme?
So he gets pilloried for having denied access. The press, of course, hates it. The editorial boards are sharpening their pencils. And he's, uh-oh. And so the next day, he comes out and says, well, I vetoed it, but I'm going to do it by executive order. What sense does that make? That's why we have a legislature.
It also is wrong, this idea that his executive order does the same thing as the two bills that he vetoed. First, it only applies to state agency. A state law would have applied to every government agency.
Including him?
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
And the second thing was that the bill would have allowed a newspaper, for example, you've never been in this position, Rex, that actually wins a case that a state agency should never have brought to hide records. They get the records from the judge. This bill would have allowed the agency, would have allowed the newspaper to collect the money for the court case from the agency.
I'm sorry, that's a misstatement by a lot of journalists. That is, in fact, allowed. We have, in fact, recovered tens of thousands of dollars from agencies who illegally withheld documents from us. We've recovered legal fees. What this bill would have done, it has been misstated in the New York Times.
Right.
It's been misstated in the editorial page of the Daily Gazette. This bill would have mandated, would have said to judges, not you may, but you shall, when there is, absent some overriding factor, when an agency intentionally withholds, which we've had examples of where officials clearly just wanted to run us around the block a few times before they gave us the documents, and we've incurred tens of thousands of dollars in legal fees, especially if you're an average citizen rather than a wealthy company like owns my newspaper, you can't do that. It is a denial, and that's what the governor vetoed. He vetoed that and did nothing about it. He's clearly, I think, trying to protect his agencies who intentionally withhold information, while at the same time pretending to be an advocate for open government.
You're right, Rex. You're absolutely right, and it's infuriating. But I have to say, it started not only with Andrew Cuomo, but it started with George Pataki before him and others in that the PIOs, public information officers, stopped operating quasi-independently for agencies, but were told it all comes from the second floor. We're going to do it. So one can only imagine that when they say no to a newspaper, they've checked it, or many times have checked it, with their boss, their political boss, who say, don't give it to them.
Yeah.
He has promised in vetoing these two bills that next session, watch him then, he's going to come in with comprehensive reform of freedom of information. And that's something we in the media must watch and hold his feet to the fire on that. I suspect this is very similar to his ethics reform in general. He promises a lot. He talks a lot. He creates structures, and then in the end, nothing happens.
Well, I'll believe it when I see it.
Right.
Exactly.
Well, you know, recently he's gone through, you make a very good point, Rosemary. There's something called an LLC. It's the way in which many people give as much money, despite campaign finance laws, restrictions to candidates as possible. And he says, yeah. I take that money, but I'm against it. And I'm going to submit a bill saying you can't do it. Don't everybody hold their breaths.
Yeah.
He should point out, by the way, that this is the difference, I think, between effective journalism and simply a recitation of facts. I often have to explain to students that facts are not always truth. So a report on what the governor did would have truthfully said the governor vetoed these bills, and he said that he was in favor of open government, and the bills were flawed, and he was trying to have more open government. That is a fact. He vetoed the bills, and he said this. Good journalism goes beyond just those facts and gives you the truth behind it. That's why, in using the word insight, I'm hoping that that is what good journalism is, because it shows that the fact of him saying that is not necessarily the truth of the matter, that it is simply a step forward. And that's difficult to get across when people sometimes say, just give me the facts and let me make my own decisions. Mm-hmm. This is, of course, what Fox News was based upon. We report, you decide. Sometimes simply saying what happened is not, in fact, good journalism.
It's not enough.
I like it.
The governor also said that the judiciary did not like these bills, and I've not heard that before either or since.
Yeah, well, let's see if there's a memo of opposition from the Office of Court Administration.
Exactly.
I suggest there was not.
Mm-hmm.
Although, you know, it's true that judges generally don't like anything that tells them what to do. They like to have free rein until they make a decision that's unpopular, and then they can say, well, actually, the law only allows me a certain amount of leeway I couldn't do. But we're not supposed to question judges, you know. There is a certain mystery behind the black robe, and the courts keep it that way. One of the things that the Scalia episode brought to the surface that we were talking about before, this question about Scalia came out in part because we now have audio tapes delayed, but we do get audio tapes of what the justices
are saying. The oral arguments.
Not the oral arguments. Mm-hmm. That didn't used to happen, and there wouldn't have been as much access, ability to discuss this if we hadn't had those tapes.
Yeah, yeah, which also proves another point. I love the fact that we have that. Don't get me wrong, but it's ridiculous. I mean, here is the Supreme Court of the United States, which has as much power as the other branches, one could argue. And there is no good reason in the world, when oral arguments are going on, that we, the people, should not have immediate television showing us. What in the world is the reason for not doing that except self-protection for these folks? So they finally gave up the ghost and let us hear it, but only after the fact.
Well, there are many who would argue that what happened to Justice Scalia is exactly why it should be kept private and secret, that he was making a wise and important legal distinction. He was eliciting information, and he's now been painted in the media as a racist.
Yes. Well, I'm sorry, Rosemary. We fought for years to get the legislature and the Congress on the television so that we could watch them. Not that anybody does, but that many people do. And I did my first sabbatical on that issue. I remember talking to Stan.
Oh, yes, I had my, what did I do on my first sabbatical? My time off to contemplate my navel. What did you, what were you saying there, Professor? Sorry.
You are such a condescending.
Just checking in. I'm sorry, did I interrupt?
I'm so sorry. When it has anything to do with the freedom of the press, boy, you're there. But when it comes to our academic credentials, maybe not so much. But I was going to say that I went to Stanley Steingut, who was then the speaker. And I said, Mr. Speaker, I have this proposal. Let's put the legislature on television. And he said, no, that's not a good idea, basically. And he said to me, the people would never allow that because they'd have to pay for it. Can you imagine the chutzpah of saying something like that?
Imagine. It took 20 more years, I suspect.
It did?
I don't know how long ago your first sabbatical was.
Well, what happens is I didn't get all that I was entitled to in terms of sabbaticals because I was too busy. However, I can say that it was my original impetus that probably led to the whole thing, chain reaction, although there would be many others who would deny.
Yeah.
There would be many others who would deny.
Can't imagine. All right. This is the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, and Rex Smith here for you if you want to offer your thoughts. Media@wamc.org. Here's an interesting discussion that came out at a panel of discussing millennials and the media. The chief digital officer of E.W. Scripps, which was a great old newspaper chain. Now I think they've moved entirely into broadcast.
I thought they made an aspirin.
Scripps?
Scripts.
Never mind. Okay. I got it. He says there's no magic formula to attracting millennials. That would be those between 18 and 28 or 30 roughly now. Those are
my students.
Your students, yeah.
And your age group.
No magic. He says, this is from Adam Simpson, the chief digital officer. He says, first you have to find out what they want and then deliver it. That's the way to build audience. The problem is not that you're not on Apple TV or on Sling, talking about the platforms they get their news on. A specific portion of that audience doesn't want what you're selling. He says, traditional media has to, quote, start thinking about our product like a consumer product company would, with research first and then worry about distribution.
Which is dangerous, right? Because it's very dangerous because basically, let's say we have I'm not calling the millennium crowd intellectually slovenly.
I'm not saying that.
Yeah, okay. But just say, find out what they want and give it to them. Now, what if they don't want it? What if they don't want to be good citizens? What if they don't want to know a thing, which is true in large part, about what's happening in government? What if they're basically turned off? So now you go out, you do your study, say they don't want it. Okay, what's the answer to that? Okay, if they don't want it, don't give it to them. Now, Rex, in his advocacy of contemporary journalism, has always claimed that the great thing you could do on a front page of a newspaper is give them some of what they do want and some of what they don't want, pretty much like you feed a baby.
But in social media, you don't get that. They can hone in on exactly what they want. We've discussed it here. A number of studies have shown that the millennials simply are not interested in news, in international news, in big national news, and local news. They don't care. What they do care about, celebrity news, entertainment, sports, sensational news, and people always like that, and news about their friends. So where does that leave the traditional news media?
Well, it's interesting because I just got a study somebody sent me showing that radio listenership is doing very well. And I have a feeling that I've always felt it has to do with the car. You get in the car, you turn something on, and you know, you don't want to be alone. You listen to the radio. But the downside of that is that soon we'll be having driverless cars,
right,
and people will be turning around and watching television.
Or playing with their smartphones.
As it is, increasingly, as cars come equipped with digital, with computers as opposed to over the air, you don't really need all those towers that you have. What do you call those? Transmitters. You don't really need all those transmitters because if people want to listen to WAMC, they can just go to the app and listen to it wherever they go.
Well,
right?
That's true, Rex, except that I keep talking to my vice president for operations here and saying, shouldn't we sell some of these stations? We got 29 stations. Shouldn't we sell some of them? Because otherwise, we're going to have a lot of things on our hand. He said, no, basically, parenthesis, unspoken, you dope. because those antennas are going to be providing the data that brings you the stuff that you need.
The antennas are worthwhile even if the signals become less so. Interesting. Well, you learn something every day.
Yes, you do, especially when you hang around with me.
Thank you, Professor. So it is difficult because the front page of the newspaper where you would have your broccoli and your ice cream, your mix of the important news and a little bit of a lively piece, would almost, people would happen across something. We've talked about this many times. And nowadays, as you say, with social media enabling people to specifically pick up only what they want, there is a lot that is not being accessed by the millennials, by younger readers. There are exceptions to this, of course. My brilliant daughter being, a 20-year-old.
And by the way, she is brilliant, and she's a brilliant writer.
She's a wonderful columnist. Thank you. Yes, she is. She writes a column in her college paper. Yes, but my wife is a great editor, so this works. But enough about me.
Never, never.
But the fact is, I'm sympathetic to this because we have a free website and then a paid section of the website. You have to be registered. You have to pay a little bit of money, 99 cents a week, really. A dollar a week is what you pay for all digital access. But if you don't pay that dollar a week, you don't get our best reporting.
Yes.
You get just the free stuff, which is what this
And you have to decide, right, Rexy, which we're going to get and which we're not.
Yes.
Which is why some of us pay for it.
And the hard reporting, the serious, the enterprise journalism, which makes all the difference, is behind the paywall.
Yes. Well, the problem for me is I want a lot of access. So, if we buy the Times Union, if we buy the New York Times, what do we do?
You can afford it, Alan.
Well, it's true. I can.
Mm-hmm.
But I think your very good point, Rex, is that not everybody can.
Yeah.
And therefore, they're getting basically segregated information. They're getting the good stuff and maybe the not so good stuff.
And not everybody wants to because American schools have de-emphasized social studies. There's been virtually no civics education for the past generation. And the result is that a lot of young people have grown up not recognizing why they need to have access to any of this important information.
Mm-hmm.
So it really does begin. Our circulation problems, our market penetration problems all begin with education. Finally, a little word from Bernie Sanders, the often ignored candidate, we're all talking about the comb-over man, whom we haven't mentioned on this broadcast, nor should we say that name. Bernie Sanders is
upset. T-word?
Yeah, the T-word. Yeah. Bernie Sanders is, he's had a longstanding criticism of the national news media. He stepped it up. He says that he's been all but ignored by television network newscasts. He says they're controlled by a handful of large corporations, and they're just too busy to pay attention to me.
Well, he's got a point. If they don't report on what he's saying, how in heck can he get ahead?
You have a point there. The media in his home state of Vermont, meanwhile, say they don't have access to him since he started running for president.
They would run information about him, which could be picked up by the national media. And he's decided, no, he's too big for that. He's aiming for network news. Donald Trump talks to everybody. If Vermont called him up, he'd be there.
Yeah.
He was on Jimmy Kimmel last night, does rallies every day. He's in the news for many reasons, but not the least of that is that he is accessible to the extreme.
Yeah. We only have a couple of seconds. I wanted to say very quickly, I was doing an interview the other day with WVOX in New Rochelle, New York.
Uh-huh.
At least one president lives in within that area, and
one
governor.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yes.
And they mentioned the Media Project, which we play, well, I believe we play here on WVOX.
Isn't that a wonderful thing?
Who knew?
We're very grateful to WVOX and to all of you out there listening to the Media Project. Sure. Alan Shartok, Rosemary Romeo, and Rex Smith, we thank you for joining us this week once again.
Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff, what a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.